This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. If you came from another planet and tuned into American TV around this time of year, you'd see commercials urging us to buy all sorts of things for Christmas. You'd see commercials and news stories about both the Black Friday sales and the crush of shoppers practically stampeding for the doorbuster items. And you'd hear about Cyber Monday, when everyone trolls the internet in an effort to snag great deals on even more stuff. In short, you might think we are all consumed with consuming. Aside from the fact that our economy is sort of based on our participation in all of this, why do we do it? Is it just because we feel we must, particularly at this time of year, if we don't want to look like Ebenezer Scrooge? Is it the thrill of the hunt for those perfect items that will make our loved ones happy? Is it because we all think that we ourselves will find happiness in the latest fashion bauble or piece of technology? You know, some see this constant state of acquisition as a desperate search for meaning, and they believe it's a search doomed to failure. They believe real meaning is actually found in clearing away the clutter of our stuff. They believe life is actually better when you have fewer material possessions. They are the minimalist. And today, we offer up a few for your consideration. Sounds like Rod Serling. Joshua Milburn is co-author with Ryan Nicodemus of two books on the subject, Everything That Remains, a memoir by the minimalists, and Minimalism, Live a Meaningful Life. The two have also participated in a TED Talk on the topic and operate the website theminimalists.com. And they have a documentary coming out sometime next year. It's called Minimalism, the Documentary. Now, we planned on having Joshua Milburn with us solo, but for some reason, even as a minimalist, he felt the need to augment his appearance with his partner, Ryan Nicodemus. So we have both of them in a studio in Montana. Welcome, guys.
You know, everything we do is steeped in irony, right? If you call yourselves the minimalists, just be prepared to be made fun of constantly.
Well, thank you for joining us. It's very early.
Thank you for having us.
You're welcome.
Good morning. Thanks for having us.
And with us in our studio is Matt McLaughlin. Matt saw Josh and Ryan's TEDx video and felt an immediate connection to the topic, and then embarked on something we'll talk about in the course of the hour, the 30-day minimalist challenge. I take it you succeeded at that challenge and are now officially stamped, verified, a minimalist.
I made it through about 20 days, and then I ran out of stuff to give away. But
really?
Yeah. Because so I was already trending
so you were
towards,
poor to begin with.
Yeah. No, I was trending the minimalist route anyway, so I didn't have a lot of stuff.
All right, well, we'll talk about what all this means. Because let's get a definition first, because I know that minimalism means different things to different people. So from the guys who invented this, or at least have taken credit for inventing it, Josh and Ryan, what is it?
I think minimalism is the thing that helps us get past the things so we can make room for life's most important things, which actually aren't things at all. I mean, I think you could go back to the Stoics. You know, you could look at Epictetus or Marcus Aurelius or Seneca, and they talked about living more deliberately. I think minimalism today is different from that because it's a reaction to this consumption, this culture we've been steeped in, where we're sold this meme that we're supposed to consume in order to be happy. And I don't think that consumption is the problem. I think compulsory consumption is the problem, where we think we're going to buy a bunch of things and live this life that's going to make us happy. And that's where a lot of us go wrong.
Well, both of you evidently were caught up in that prior to your decision to pare down. Both of you you're both young, but you were younger still when you had this epiphany to do this. But you were on the career track. You were making six figures. You had stuff. One of you, I think it was Ryan, had a condominium with, and you make a point of this several times, a condominium with two living rooms. Mm-hmm. I guess that means a living room and a family room. So when did the move to shed your outward trappings of that success begin to be an attraction, and why? You worked hard to get there.
I was 28 years old, and up until that point, I had everything I ever wanted, the six-figure salary, the big house with more bedrooms than people, the luxury cars, and all the stuff to fill every corner of my consumer-driven lifestyle. I was living the American dream. But then my mom died and my marriage ended, both in the same month. And these two events forced me to look around and start to question what had become my life's focus. And I realized that I was so focused on so-called success and achievement and especially on the accumulation of stuff. And I was living the American dream, but it wasn't my dream. And it took getting everything I thought I wanted to realize that everything I ever wanted wasn't actually what I wanted at all. So I discovered this thing called minimalism, and I started letting go and paring down. And over the course of about 8 months, I let go of about 90% of my material possessions, which sounds crazy to some people at first. But I think if you came to my home today, you wouldn't walk in and say, "Oh my God, this guy's a minimalist." You'd probably walk in and say, "Wow, Josh is pretty tidy." And it's because I don't own a lot of stuff, but everything I do own adds real value to my life, whether it's my car or my furniture or my clothes. Everything, as a minimalist, everything serves a purpose or brings me joy, and everything else is out of the way. But it took getting through those sort of difficult events for me to realize that I put too much emphasis on the things that weren't truly important.
So you were the first of the two of you to pare down. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. But then people at work started noticing that I was less stressed. People would make comments like, "You seem so much calmer. What is going on with you? You seem so much nicer." and then Ryan, we've known each other since we were fat little fifth graders, and we're both 34 now. And he came to me one day and he said, "Why the hell are you so happy?"
Yeah, I noticed this huge difference in Josh. It didn't really make sense to me why he was happy, because we had worked at the same corporation throughout our 20s, both climbing the ranks together, and he had been just as miserable as me. And then to boot, he had had those two occurrences happen, two of the most difficult events of his life, where his mom passed away and his marriage ended. So, yeah, I went to him, and I'm like, "What's going on with you, man? Did they put you on some Prozac, or are you on drugs or what?" And he introduced me to this thing called minimalism. And at the time, I was in a very similar spot. You had mentioned, you know, I had the condo, 2,000 square foot, 3 bedrooms, 2 bathrooms, 2 living rooms. And yeah, to your point, I don't know why I had 2 living rooms. It was kind of this American dream that I had been chasing my whole life. And,
well, he had a cat, so right. Kind of need 2 living rooms.
Yeah, yeah.
So, I was just going to say, Josh had these two tragic events occur. Two of the worst things that can happen in a person's life is the death of a loved one and the dissolution of a marriage. You had both happen to you in the same month. Then yeah. Matt, I understand. Ryan, you. You were laid off. So my question is, and you want to jump in there and correct me about something I can tell.
Yeah, yeah, I was laid off. It was about a year after we had launched the website.
Okay.
I had kind of been preparing for the layoff.
Right.
I knew that was a possibility for sure.
But my
minimalism, I mean, but to that point though, minimalism helped me prepare for that, because I got to tell you, if I was laid off and I hadn't started to simplify my life and start living more deliberately, I would have been in a really, really tight situation.
And by deliberately, do you mean more economically, fewer debts?
Yeah. I think that when I say deliberately, I mean deliberate with all of my resources. So yes, finances are certainly a part of that, but I'm also talking about my attention. I'm also talking about my time. I was starting to focus more on things that brought lasting happiness instead of going after ephemeral pacifiers, so to speak.
So Matt McLaughlin's been sitting quietly in our studio practicing real minimalism by not saying anything. So let me give him a chance to say something. Is your story similar to theirs, or is it completely different?
It is similar. Around 2010, 2011, my dad had health problems and he was downsizing. So I attained everything in his attic that had been accumulating for 30 years of mine. And, have an 800 square foot condo, and every nook and cranny was packed with some kind of box or something. And I just hit a breaking point. And, so I found Josh and Ryan's TEDx talk, And I was like, wow, this is actually a thing, minimalism. And just never looked back, really. Just gave away, like Josh said, 90%, you know, of my possessions. And that's where I started.
So you had kind of a tragic event. Joshua, you certainly had a tragic event, two of them in a row in the same month. Is that what it takes? Does it take some kind of an apocalyptic event to trigger this in a lot of people? Or can you just, from listening to this conversation today, decide, you know, this makes sense to me, I'm going to do it? Is it easy to do it, or do you need a tragic event to trigger it and stick to it?
Well, I didn't really have – this is Ryan. I didn't really have a tragic event happen to me. For me, it was more of a buildup. And, yeah, I think there are a lot of people right now in the world, especially in North America, who are experiencing this this workplace burnout. And that's exactly where I was. My life was consumed with my job. It was consumed with – I was going to school at the time too. So 60, 70, sometimes 80 hours a week I was working. And yes, something eventually did have to give. I was spending a lot of time at the bars. I was doing a lot of drugs. Like I said, I was searching for a lot of ephemeral things, and I knew that would last only so long. And minimalism was something that could help me regain control.
Let me ask the three of you, is there anything about this, now that you've pared down, anything about this that either the possessions that you got rid of that you miss, or do you have to fight the desire to acquire?
Yeah, I wish that we could write a book that just took away that urge to buy stuff. We would charge a lot more for it. But, you know, even today, I still certainly have the urge to buy things. You know, when the iPhone 6 came out, my first thought was, huh, contract's up. That's a fancy new phone. I can get it for $99. I mean, that was my first thought. And I really had to consider that and ask myself, what is this phone going to do for me? How is this phone going to add additional value to my life? And when I looked into it, it really didn't do anything more than what my phone does right now. And now I'm sure there's someone out there who could totally counter that and give me a million reasons why the iPhone 6 is way better. And that's great for that person.
There's actually a commercial right now for the phone that answers that question, because it's been criticized that the iPhone 6 is no better than the iPhone 5. But clearly, Apple thinks that it is. What about you, man?
Of course they do.
That's right.
But
go ahead.
So for me
go ahead, Matt.
Okay. I was just going to say, for me, this time of year is particularly tough because I have an 8-year-old nephew, and I want to buy him, you know, everything he wants. But and shout out to Mason, by the way. Wanted to throw that out there. I just wanted to it's very tough this time of year, because you do get so many commercials and messages thrown your way that you really just have to kind of be aware.
Well, let's come back and talk about that, because we are in the middle of the holiday season, and it's not just you not buying stuff for yourself. It's how, as a minimalist, how do you act toward others at this time of year, and how do you want them to act toward you? Bah, humbug. We're coming right back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
We'll get back to our encore conversation on minimalists here on Charlotte Talks in just a moment. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Nexen Pruitt, lawyers helping companies meet business challenges in court, with regulators, and at the deal table, with offices in Charlotte and 7 other Carolina locations. Next challenge, next level, Nexen Pruitt. And from Gardner Webb University, a private Christian liberal arts experience dedicated to preparing students for success around the corner and around the world. Ignite your future at gardner-webb.edu. It's back to the drawing board for North Carolina lawmakers. A federal court says they lean too much on race when drawing up dozens of districts in the state legislature. Those districts will have to be redrawn, and new elections have been ordered for next year. The state's congressional districts are also under scrutiny. The Supreme Court is deciding if those districts were drawn along racial or political lines. A closer look at gerrymandering with guest host Dr. Michael Bitzer when Charlotte Talks tomorrow morning at 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
On the next Diane Rame Show, the president-elect's pick of retired neurosurgeon Ben Carson to head the Department of Housing and Urban Development could signal a dramatic shift for the agency, federal housing policies, and how they may change.
Join the Diane Rame Show from 10 to noon following Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about minimalism with three minimalists, Joshua Milburn and Ryan Nicodemus. Run the blog, theminimalist.com. They have two books they've written together about this, Everything That Remains, a memoir by the minimalists, and Minimalism, Live a Meaningful Life. And we have a local minimalist in our studio. Matt McLaughlin is also with us. Henry David Thoreau once said, "A man is rich in proportion to the number of things which he can afford to let alone," which is where these guys are coming from. But it is Christmas time, and we are bombarded. First of all, it's kind of built into the DNA of most people in Western civilization that Christmas is a time for giving, and for some, more importantly, receiving. So how do you handle this time of year? Because people, loved ones, want to probably give you things, and yet you're trying to pare down. You, I think, Matt, you brought up the fact that you have an 8-year-old nephew that you'd like to give everything he wanted, which flies in the face of minimalism. You're setting this little boy up for a life of hellish consumption. So so how do you handle this holiday?
Well, for me, I mean, I will just give him one gift. That's pretty much what I always do. And I'll give him something that he'll use and will last a long time. Uh-huh.
What do you want people to give you?
I would like people to give me money. No, I'm just kidding. I don't know. People can give me just their time, you know, just hanging out, letting me know what's up. Okay. I mean, I don't want anything. There's nothing that I need.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Guys,
I agree
with
Matt there. I mean, I think presents is the best present. Yesterday, I went out with my partner and her 2-year-old daughter, and we got a Christmas tree permit for $5 here in Montana, and we went and spent the day Christmas tree hunting. And I could tell you that I'm much more fond of gifting experiences over stuff. I mean, it's a weird holiday where we gift things obligatorily, right? Like we assume here I'm supposed to buy you something, so I bought you these $20 cufflinks that you'll never wear, and then this shiny thing proves that I love you. And we've commodified this emotion of love. And the way to get around that is to show people we care all the time, not just during the holidays, but if you want to give someone a gift, there's nothing inherently wrong with that. But you don't have to wait until December 25th to do that. You can show them you care 365 days a year. And if you do have to gift something, a physical possession, why not make it a consumable? Maybe a nice bag of coffee or a bottle of wine or something that you can enjoy together, like some concert tickets or some sort of experience that you're able to enjoy with the person you care about.
So let's talk about how you, all three of you, approached this downsizing, this discarding of possessions. Joshua and Ryan, you both were making a lot of money. You had possessions, you had a house, you had cars, you had, I'm sure you had computers and phones and big screen televisions, etc. How did you begin? I know you had one of you had a packing party.
That was me.
Right.
Yes, that is where my journey started. When Josh first introduced me to this world of minimalism, I got really excited. It made sense to me, and I'm like, great, I'm in. I'm a minimalist. Now what do I do? Because I didn't want to take the same approach that he did, spending months paring down my possessions. Like Josh, that worked for him. But, you know, I needed faster results. So that's where we came up with this idea called a packing party. And the idea was to pack all my belongings as if I were moving. So we just pretended that I was moving. Josh came over, literally helped me box up everything. It took about 9 hours. After a couple pizza deliveries, you know, we had everything in boxes marked really, really well. And I spent the next 21 days unpacking only the items I needed, my toothbrush, my bed and bed sheets, some clothes for work, a tool set, just the things that added value to my life. And after those 3 weeks, I had 80% of my stuff still sitting in boxes, just sitting there. I mean, I couldn't even tell you what was in most of those boxes. I couldn't even remember.
It's interesting you say 80% because we've done another program on this show, and people say some other statistic that we've come across said that 80% of the items we own, we never think about, we never touch, we never see, we never use.
Yeah. And that was certainly the case with me. And so I was sitting there looking at, you know, the thousands and thousands of dollars that I spent on these things, bringing them into my life to make me happy, and how they weren't doing their job. And that's when minimalism really, really rang true with me. And I donated and I sold all of it. I let go of it. And I started to feel rich for the first time in my life once I got everything out of the way to make room for everything that remains. And that's when I went to Josh and I'm like, man, this is an amazing experience I would love to share with other people. And maybe they can get value out of it. And that's where we came up with theminimalists.com, and it started with that 21-day journey.
It's a really interesting website, I have to tell you. And I saw your TEDx presentation, which people can go on the internet and see. And it's a brilliant, Penn and Teller-esque presentation.
Thank you very much. And I just want to let you know that was my whole concept.
Was it really? Well, it's very clever of you, Ryan, because you don't let Josh talk till the very end. But
that's my idea.
The whole thing with the boxes, brilliantly staged. I mean, that took a lot of forethought. Brilliantly staged, but it really gets the point across rather well. And that's the presentation, Matt, that you saw that opened your eyes to all of this. What was your approach? You said that you took that 30-day minimalist challenge, but you couldn't finish it in 30 days. You were done much before that.
Right. So the idea with that, and I found that on their blog, on Josh and Ryan's blog. The idea is you get rid of one thing the first day, two things the second day, three things the third day. So by the 20th day, you're giving away 20 things.
How did you decide what to give away first?
I just picked. I didn't really have a method. I just picked.
Was it difficult? I mean, did you have second? As you looked, you picked up an item. As you picked that item up, did you go, I don't know if I want to give this away?
Well, no, it wasn't that difficult. The first items were really easy, but then it became a habit, right? So I would just go to the Salvation Army store every day, and that was like part of my routine. Mm-hmm. Some of the things I had an attachment to and had never, you know, haven't mm-hmm. used in years, and I never miss them. So,
when you've accomplished it, is it like a weight being lifted?
It is. It's less stress. It's less clutter. I mean, I would see objects. I had snow skis in my closet for 10 years and never used them. But every time I would see them, I'd be like, hey, I need to go ski or do something. You know, these objects cause shoulds and create more stress than you really need. If the more you pare down mm-hmm. and get rid of, the less, for me anyway, the less overwhelmed I feel.
Matt called it a habit, developing a habit of giving something away every day. And on your website, theminimalist.com, you talk about a 21-day plan to declutter and shed consumer-driven lifestyles. Why 21 days?
Yeah, I think that's how long it takes. We hear this all the time to form a habit. The game that Matt's talking about, though, is called the 30-day minimalism game. We've had tens of thousands of people play it now because we all realize decluttering's pretty freaking boring. And so we found a way to make it more fun with some friendly competition. And so like Matt said, you partner up with somebody, but then you see who can go the longest. If you both make it to the end of the month, you've both won because you've both gotten rid of 500 items. You've gotten this momentum. And to answer your question about getting started, you know, quite often the way I started was just pondering each artifact in my home. I'd ask that one question: does this thing add value to my life? And what I mean by that is, does it serve a purpose in my life? Does it bring me joy? And if not, then I have to be willing to let go. Just because something doesn't add value to my life, it doesn't mean that it won't add value to someone else's life. And so finding the things a new home will, is often far more appropriate than just holding on to it in perpetuity.
Because, in fact, it may add value to somebody else's life.
Mm-hmm. It absolutely can if we're willing to let go. So by letting go, we're able to contribute beyond ourselves. But I'll tell you this, the purpose of minimalism has to do with the benefits we experience once we're on the other side of decluttering. So, you know, I think that removing the clutter is not the end result. It is merely the first step. And sure, we feel like a weight lifted off our shoulders right away, but I don't think we experience lasting contentment by just getting rid of our excess stuff. I don't think minimalism works like that. I think it's possible to get rid of everything you own. Mm-hmm. And still be utterly miserable, to come home to an empty house and sulk after removing all your pacifiers. And that's because, like I said, I don't think consumption's the problem, but compulsory consumption is the problem. Well, and the only way to change that is to make deliberate decisions to let go.
Give me some ideas of things that all of us probably have that you found easy just to give away.
Oh, man, you know, for me I would say some leftover cell phones I had in a drawer. I was holding on to these old Blackberries and smartphones, looking at them and thinking, "Man, this phone retailed for $499.99 2 years ago. I can't just, you know, give this away." But when I really thought about it, it's like, wait a minute, no one's ever going to give me $500 for that phone. It's so antiquated right now. But if I give this away, someone might be able to, you know, stick a SIM chip in it or something and get a working number, and it would be a benefit to them. So I found after I kind of took that approach, it was a lot easier to get rid of those things. I'll tell you another thing too that I was able to get rid of was all of these just-in-case items. That was probably my biggest hoarding stash was all these just-in-case items. And I would say that the cell phones were part of that, holding onto them just in case. Mm. And really, Josh and I kind of came up with a rule to help with that. We realized that in this country and in most countries, you can get anything that you absolutely need within 20 minutes for less than $20. And Josh and I lived in Phillipsburg, Montana, population 870, four bars, one church. I mean, very, very small town. And that rule has held true with us 100% of the time. Now, our theory is that it works 99% of the time, because I'm sure there's something out there that would be an exception to the rule. But this has worked for Josh and I 100% of the time.
Now, Joshua says, Matt, that minimalists don't focus on having less. Rather, they focus on making room for more time, more passion, more experiences, more growth, more contribution, more contentment, more freedom. Have you found that to be the case?
Yes, I wholeheartedly agree with that. So minimalism is just at the core of everything I do. But it frees up time by getting rid of things that you don't need. It frees up time to do things that you love. And for me, that it also, by sharing things I own. So the sharing economy is huge for me. I share my house. I share my car. I would share anything. I would share my computer. I would share my cell phone, whatever, because it affords me the ability to not have a 9-to-5 job, so I can go watch a TEDx Charlotte event. I can go play a show for Charlotte School of Rock, which is something that I'm involved with. And I can go participate in Skookum Night Shift. I mean, there's all these things that you can do in Charlotte that it's very hard to do if you have a 9-to-5 job.
Well, there are people in the government right now listening, the IRS among them, shuddering at this because if this catches on, the sharing economy, they can't tax it. And if you don't have a 9-to-5 job, you don't have a 1040 form to fill out. And if you are a minimalist and you're not consuming, there's no sales tax to be derived. So you're going to break the bank on the United States economy here. That's pretty scary stuff for some people. Do all three of you have jobs or do you not have jobs? You don't have a job, Matt. So
I have a business. I have two businesses. I have a startup and then I have a
You do have a job.
I have a job. It's just not a corporate job. It's not a big bank job. Which I'm a big fan of the big banks. Yeah. And I hope you can hear the sarcasm in my voice there.
Josh and Ryan, I would take it then that this has become an industry for you. Minimalism has become the big kahuna for you, right?
Again, steeped in irony, right? I don't think there's anything inherently wrong with working a 9-to-5. I think where we go wrong is we associate with our identity with that job title. In fact, it's one of the first questions we ask each other, right? When you meet someone new, what do you ask?
What do you do?
What do you do?
And you don't like that question. That's
life's most dangerous question, right? Because what we're really saying is, where do you work? How much money do you make? So I can compare you to me on the socioeconomic ladder. But if you were to posit the question that way, you'd just sound like a jerk. And so instead, we say, "What do you do?" And the truth is, that's an expansive question. I do lots of things. You know, I might go hiking. I drink water. I wear blue jeans. But what we're really saying is how do you earn money? And there's nothing wrong with earning money. I think we all need to pay the bills, and we all need some stuff. The question is what we're doing deliberate? Are we making money so we can live the life we want to live, or are we living just to work? Mm-hmm. And Ryan and I sort of experienced the epitome of that, working 80 hours a week in the corporate world. I was a director of operations for 150 retail stores, which, again, I know is ironic with the whole minimalism thing. But what I realized is I was working so much. All of my life was focused on that, and it wasn't focused on my health. You know, I weighed 80 pounds more than I weigh now. It wasn't focused on my relationships. As I mentioned, my marriage ended. It wasn't focused on what I was passionate about. I wasn't focused about growing or contributing beyond myself in another way to other people. And so I discovered that by regaining control of my life, and I use minimalism to do that, it wasn't about just getting rid of the stuff. It was about regaining control of all of these other areas that were truly important.
So, and I have about 2 minutes left here in this segment, but which is more difficult? I'd like to hear it from all three of you if we have time. Which is more difficult, the initial paring down and moving toward this minimalist goal or maintaining it going forward once you've done it?
I think the initial part is the most difficult because we don't have any momentum. It's changing directions when you've been going 100 miles an hour in this consumerist direction. But once you develop the habits by asking questions like, does this thing add value to my life? And then starting to ask deeper questions. Why have I been so discontented? Why have I given so much meaning to my material possessions? Who's the person I want to become? How am I going to define my own success? Like, these are difficult questions, but they're much more important than just cleaning out our closets. You know, if we don't understand the purpose of minimalism, then the closet we just declutter will be brimming with new clothes, new purchases in the not-too-distant future. And so I think it's really about getting momentum. And that's why things like the 30-day minimalism game, having an accountability partner, getting started. Because once you get momentum, embracing minimalism gets easier by the day. I think the more action you take, the more you want to take action because you start to feel the benefits. You feel happier. You feel freer. You feel lighter. And then the people around you start to notice it too.
That's Joshua, right?
Yes.
Yes. Yeah. Joshua, who didn't get the chance to talk in the video, and gets to talk all the time.
Well, I hear music, so I think we're supposed to trail off in some meaningful way.
We are, and we'll come back. We need to be minimalists right now, but then we'll come back and let I'll hear from Ryan and Matt about that same question, which is more difficult, starting or maintaining it all. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Our encore presentation on minimalists coming up in a moment here on Charlotte Talks. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Bradley, formerly Bradley A. Rent Bolt Cummings, a full-service law firm serving business litigation needs locally and across the nation. The name has changed, but dedication to serving clients and communities remains. Bradley.com. And from Charlotte Ballet's Nutcracker, a holiday tradition with over 100 dancers and the Charlotte Symphony. Now through the 23rd at Belk Theater. Tickets and information at charlotteballet.org. Coming up in 20 minutes on the Diane Rehm Show, a look at federal housing policies and how they may shift during the Trump administration. That conversation at 10 o'clock following Charlotte Talks. Before the lights go out of the Double Door Inn here in Charlotte, Charlotte Talks is looking back at the popular music venues more than 40 years in the city. Do you have a story to share about the Double Door? We want to hear it. Send us your story in an email or a voice memo. You can find details at WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks.
It's your world. We help you explore it.
The death of Fidel Castro is a chance to reflect on the past and also a chance to think about Cuba's future.
It's your community. We help you understand it.
Why would CMPD not just come to the people?
Braxton Winston was asking CMPD Major Mike Campagna about another shooting.
Morning Edition on WFAE is an essential way to start your day and stay connected to your world. Listen weekday mornings from 5 to 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about minimalism with three experts, because they all three practice it. Joshua Milburn and Ryan Nicodemus are both co-authors of books called Everything That Remains, a memoir by the minimalists, and Minimalism, Live a Meaningful Life. They also have outlined the principles as they see them of minimalism and how to get into it, how to practice it, and why you should, and what the benefits are, on their website, TheMinimalists.com. And they're joining us from Montana. In our studio, Matt McLaughlin is with us. He's a minimalist. And before we continue our conversation with him, let's hear from another expert on the topic, an unlikely expert on the topic, George Carlin.
I would have been out here a little bit sooner, but they gave me the wrong dressing room, and I couldn't find any place to put my stuff. And I don't know how you are, but I need a place to put my stuff. So that's what I've been doing back there, just trying to find a place for my stuff. You know how important that is. That's the whole meaning of life, isn't it? Trying to find a place for your stuff. That's all your house is. Your house is just a place for your stuff. If you didn't have so much stuff, you wouldn't need a house. You could just walk around all the time. That's all your house is. It's a pile of stuff with a cover on it. You see that when you take off in an airplane and you look down and you see everybody's got a little pile of stuff. Everybody's got their own pile of stuff. And when you leave your stuff, you gotta lock it up. Wouldn't want somebody to come by and take some of your stuff. They always take the good stuff. They don't bother with that crap you're saving. Ain't nobody interested in your fourth grade arithmetic papers. They're looking for the good stuff. That's all your house is. It's a place to keep your stuff while you go out and get more stuff.
Uh-huh. Now, that was, I don't know, 40 years ago he said that. So he was on to something 40 years ago, George Carlin was. I want to get an answer from Ryan and from Matt about the question we were talking about just prior to the break. What's more difficult? What is easier, starting or maintaining? Matt, go ahead.
I would say for me it's maintaining. Because the more things I get involved with, the more demands I have. And also, family members pass away and you get their stuff. Like my dad passed recently. So I got all my possessions doubled instantly. And I don't want to give this stuff away because it makes me feel better to have them. But eventually it's going to become stuff again. Mm-hmm. And I will give it away. But it does help me cope with that. And so the maintenance is hard for me.
Lisa, you emails that in 1997, we sold everything and our house and bought a sailboat. In 1999, we took off sailing from Nova Scotia to the Bahamas, working when we needed to top the jar, construction mostly. We saw money as freedom chips. This all came from reading Your Money or Your Life. When the major job was downsized, we were okay, but if we hadn't started to downsize, we would have had to go through bankruptcy. Less is more, and don't pay attention to people who think that things bring happiness. Happiness comes from experiences and being with someone you love. Which kind of echoes what you have said, Ryan, in the last 45 minutes, stuff doesn't make you happy, and if you hadn't downsized, you would have been in real trouble. Is it harder for you to maintain it, or is it easier for you to maintain it?
I would say it's easier for me to maintain it than it was to get started. I would echo what Josh said earlier before the break. Getting that momentum is by far the hardest part. Because I got to tell you, when I moved from that 2,000 square foot condo, you know, paying $2,000 a month, going into a $450 a month place, I had a lot of joy out of that. it felt really, really good because I knew that I was developing a life where I wasn't relying on this huge salary and I wouldn't have to give my time.
But it's got to be hard for anybody to do this because we are literally – we live in a culture of consumption. We live in a culture where the economy depends on our consuming things. Advertising, we are bombarded by advertising, telling us not only that we should buy stuff, but that we need this stuff. and at Christmas time, when they're showing you all the stuff they want to sell you, everybody is smiling. So it's making them happy that they're getting this stuff and that they're buying this stuff. And now advertising is not just targeted at a demographic. It's targeted at you, directly at you, and it follows you around. If you have a smartphone or you use Google or some other search engine, it follows you around. How do you fight that?
You know, I think one of the biggest arguments, supposed arguments, that many people have against minimalism is that if everyone became a minimalist, then we'd all be doomed. The financial system as it stands today would collapse and you know, we wouldn't have enough money to buy cheap plastic things at Walmart. And basically, I mean, I think there are several problems with this point of view. And I don't think – first off, I don't think there's anyone who would argue that we need to stop consuming altogether. We all need some stuff. The problem is the impulsive, the vapid, pernicious side. And you see it advertised all the time. But I think using consumerism to stimulate the economy is like fixing a cracked mirror with a hammer. You know, basically, it just worsens the problem. You know, we've been told that we need to stimulate the economy, especially after the crash in 2008. Stimulate the economy, stimulate the economy. But that's fixing the problem with the problem. And I think circumventing consumerism doesn't imply that minimalism sidesteps commerce. I think that minimalism is about intentional consumption, and sometimes we hear this that we're overly materialistic, but maybe we're not materialistic enough. Maybe we don't care about the things that we bring into our life enough to show that, well, when I bring this in, I really need to care about it. It really needs to serve a purpose or bring me joy.
Joshua, you say you're not a Stoic and you're not a Luddite, but you do conduct Stoical experiments like living without internet at home, without a phone, living a year without purchasing material possessions, living without a television, and without goals.
Yeah.
My gosh.
You know,
I don't even know where to go with that.
I don't think minimalism is about deprivation, but occasionally I like to deprive myself temporarily to see whether or not I actually get value from something that I think I do. And so it started for me with the TV, and it turns out that, you know, I didn't need that. But of course I held on to my radio because I like to listen to NPR every day. But
good answer.
I learned that Some things do add immense value to my life, and by removing it for a certain period of time, I can bring it back in and get far more joy from it. The goals thing is I had a friend who said he started living without goals and he was much happier. And I think there's a time when goals are important. If you're I would liken it to being in a crater. If you're in a crater, you need to get out of that crater. For me, that was like my health. I needed to lose weight. I needed to get out of debt. I made really good money, but I spent even better money. And so I had massive amounts of debt. And so having goals to get out of a crater is great. But once you're out and you're on flat land, I think it's much more important to find a direction and head in that direction. So I live without goals for 100 days, and I wrote about it. And I actually didn't even have that as a goal at first. I didn't want to make it a goal, right? But ultimately, I learned that I'm much more focused on the journey than I am on the destination. And so by letting go temporarily, I'm able to figure out what I actually enjoy, what brings me value.
Brian, in your TED Talk, you say that this has allowed you to reclaim your time, live in the moment, and pursue your passions. Let's talk about each of those things for just a couple of seconds here.
Sure.
How has this allowed you to have more of your own time? Because you don't have to work so hard? Is that why?
Yeah, I mean, that was really kind of the initial reason why I got excited about minimalism, because I had got myself in the situation where I had to rely on a six-figure salary and working 80 hours a week to get that. And when I saw minimalism, I was like, yeah, this makes sense. If I don't have a car payment and I don't have a huge condo payment, I don't have to work as much. Maybe I could actually go be a barista and work part-time and get, you know, 30, 40, 50 hours back. And that was certainly the initial direction. But not only that, but the smaller space that I have, I mean, now it takes me, oh, I don't know, probably 45 minutes to an hour to clean my whole place, whereas before it was, you know, it was an entire weekend extravaganza getting my huge condo clean. So I've saved time that way as well.
What about living in the moment?
Yeah, living in the moment. I mean, that is something that I have always worked hard towards. And minimalism certainly has helped me get there. But what I have found is that with less stuff, I am able to focus more. Because I believe that a lot of my physical possessions, and I'm sure this holds true for many other people, it was a physical manifestation of what was going on inside of my head. And once I was able to clear that physical clutter out of my life, I was able to start working and getting a lot of that mental clutter out of the way as well.
And
you quoted Thoreau earlier, mm-hmm. and one of my favorite quotes is from Thoreau. He said, "It's not enough to be busy. The question is, what are you busy about?" And if I were to pin that, I would basically just say, "What are you focused on?" And I think the busy has become the worst four-letter word in the vocabulary for me, because it apes the form of action when we're not actually doing anything. And so we're constantly, incessantly checking our email or our Facebook or whatever. And none of those things are inherently bad. They're just tools. But we've conditioned ourselves to constantly be busy. It's a mark of status. And by getting rid of busy, Ryan and I do far fewer things than we used to in the corporate world, but we're much more focused on the things that are actually important. And so living in the moment has a lot to do with what you're focused on right now.
You also talk, Ryan, about pursuing your passions. And mm-hmm. I would think a lot of people are so caught up in doing what you were doing, making a living and supporting the infrastructure that you have created with a six-figure job that has to be continually supported. There was no time probably to pursue passions. Did you know what your passions were prior to clearing away the clutter and giving yourself time?
Yeah, if you were to ask me what I was passionate about 5 years ago, I would have looked at you like a deer in headlights. You know, what am I passionate about? I had no idea. I was living paycheck to paycheck, living for a paycheck, living for stuff, living for a career I didn't love. But yeah, I was able to discover writing as a passion. I'm able to snowboard now a lot more living in Missoula, Montana. I've had a board for like 10 years. It's old and chipped up, but it still goes down the hill really fast. So I'm able to do that a lot more. I'm able to just experience things now, going back to removing that mental clutter and really put time and effort into things that do bring me
joy. What did your friend, all three of you, what did your friends think when you suddenly started to change and pare down and quit jobs and dispense with possessions? Did they look at you funny?
Yeah, my mom called me up about a month after we had launched the website. She's like, "Hey, son, what's this minimalist crap?" And I'm like, oh, you found the website. Because we didn't tell anyone about it. She must have Googled my name or something. And she's like, "What does this mean? I mean, are you not going to be around for holidays anymore? Can I not buy you anything anymore?" And I'm like, "Mom, you know, I love you, and I will totally be around for the holidays. In fact, I hope to be around more than that, because that's about the only time I saw her. When I was living this crazy life." And I'm like, "No, Mom, I'm trying to actually see you more, hang out with you more." I said, "But as far as buying me things, like, yeah, I would rather you not buy me any physical items unless it's something I really need." And she's like, "Well, I'm your mother, and I'm going to buy you stuff anyway," which I suppose she has that right to do. And I said, "Well, Mother, if you buy me something and I can't use it, if it doesn't bring me joy, I'm gonna have to find someone who can use it, or I'm gonna have to donate it or do something with it."
Wow.
Which is not the thing to say to your mother, by the way. we kind of went back and forth. She got a little upset, but really, you know, at the end of the day, I just kind of stopped and paused, and I said, "Mom, you know, I love you so much, and you love me too, right?" She's like, "Yeah, of course I love you." And I said, I want you to be happy. You want me to be happy too, right? She's like, yeah, of course I want you to be happy. Well, I said, if that's the case, all I need is your support. If you truly love me and you want me to be happy, just please support me. It doesn't mean that you have to have a packing party. It doesn't mean that when I come to your home, I'm going to judge the things in your home. All I'm asking for is a little bit of support. And that really, really got through to her heart. And I had to have that conversation with a few different friends. And I did lose some friends along the way. Mm. But looking back, it was very much worth finding who my real friends were. I mean, as soon as you call yourselves the minimalists, you find out pretty quick who your friends are.
So, Matt, I mean, I just on the flip side of that question, we are defined by what we own and who we are and how we consume, et cetera. So when you change your lifestyle, do friends walk away? Have they walked away from you?
No, not at all.
Can you keep up with them? Your friend has the latest iPhone. Yeah, you probably don't.
The biggest problem I have is being overcommitted, and because I have more time, so I tend to volunteer for a lot of causes like Big Brother, Big Sister, and Code for America and stuff like that. And I just lose track of my friends. But a lot of my friends are already minimalist trend. They practice it. It's more the older generation, like Josh or Ryan was saying. My mother, has a hard time with it. She wants to give me stuff, and I'm like, I just don't want it.
I have a minute left. Are you single?
Yes.
Okay, all three of you were single when you started on this quest to minimize, to downsize, to pare down. Is it easier when you're by yourself, or can this be accomplished if you have a spouse or a partner, or if you have children?
It's much easier when you're by yourself, for sure. You're right. We were both, Ryan and I were both single when we first took this journey. Neither one of us are now, and my partner has a 2-year-old. But I can tell you, it's actually far more important now that you have other people in your life, that you're setting a good example for them, because it's about focusing on what's truly important.
That's Joshua Milburn, who, along with Ryan Nicodemus, are co-authors of Everything That Remains, a memoir by the Minimalists, and Minimalism, Living Meaningful Life. They also have a website called theminimalists.com and a documentary, Minimalism, coming out in 2016. And Matt McLaughlin joined us in our studio, a local minimalist. You want one thing you want, one thing you need, one thing to wear, one thing to read. That's all you need.